welcome back to another episode of Analyst Insider with me, Jack J. Today we're speaking to none other than Click from G2 Esports. He is their research slash scouting analyst, and he offers a really great and different perspective to a lot of the other analysts we've spoken to recently who have been in more technical roles like data engineers or full stack developers. So we're really going to dig into that scouting role and understand what it is he does on a day-to-day basis, some top tips on how to improve at the role and also how to break into that sort of position in a team. Now, this is actually our 10th and last episode of the Analyst Insider series, at least for now. We've spoken to a lot of great analysts, and we're certainly going to be producing other similar content, but this will be the last of the interview series. If you are interested in this sort of content, you want to see what we're doing, you want to speak to some analysts, you want to get some tips on how to actually become an analyst yourself, then I once again highly recommend you check out the Itero Discord. There will be a link in the description or the comments or whatever, where you can join and speak to fellow like-minded individuals. In the meantime, please do enjoy this interview. Welcome to the interview, Click.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I will try to keep awkward smiles to the minimum.
That's okay. Me and you both.
Yeah, I'm a bit introverted, so doing an interview is a bit out of my routine, but I will try to be as human as possible.
Yeah, I think when we discussed this in the Discord, you mentioned something around about trying to do more outward interview stuff like this, content creation in 2023, and this one interview will be your entire quota for the year.
Yeah, pretty much. Rodrigo will probably roast me for it, so I'm ready to do my best.
Okay, we will try not creating too much memeable content then. Awesome. Let's jump into it. I've done some research into you, and you were both a player originally, right? An analyst and a head coach. You seem to have about 15 teams in your Wikipedia. So this is going to be probably our longest background question. So let's jump into that one. Can you give us a brief overview of this very extensive background that you have in esports?
All right. So basically, I've done it all. I originally started as like a player, very low tier player, but player nonetheless. I tried to compete. Didn't work so well because I was young and human interaction was hard. But I still loved the game very much, so I still wanted to compete, but in a different role. So I jumped into analyst, and from there into coaching, back to analyst, into back into coaching. Basically, whatever the job was available, I was like, yeah, I can do it. Because of that, I jumped a lot of different staff roles across the years and different regions.
Awesome. So more recently, the names that I remember, Eminem, people I've interacted with because they're in the UK scene. So you're an analyst for them, right? Yeah, I think that's 2021. And then Schalke in 2021 as well. And then now you're G2.
That Schalke might be thinking of our team.
Oh, sorry, Fenerbahce. Yeah, sorry, I've got them confused. Yeah, Fenerbahce.
Fenerbahce 1,000. Okay, no, I cannot tell it in English. No.
Good attempt.
1907. Let's just call it that.
Yeah. Cool. And then G2 since summer of 2022.
Yes.
Awesome. And you're the first person we've spoken to who calls himself a research analyst. So could you just explain what it means when you call yourself a research analyst and how that might be different to a data analyst or a scouting analyst?
A research analyst is a new term. It's copyrighted by G2 Esports, so anyone who uses it will have to pay us royalties. Well, basically, I don't know, guess Rodrigo was bored or something, so they decided to call my role research analyst. Mostly it pertains to scouting role, but in broad sense, we call it research because I'm researching our teams, our leagues, and I'm trying to keep track of all the games and meta across the scene and generally report that to the rest of the staff.
Awesome, awesome. So would that require a lot of VOD watching and report writing, or do you do some scouting in the data sense? Like how do you actually scout, let's say, another region?
I mean, it depends a lot on what, if you are asked to target something specifically, for example, a strategy or a method of playing, you usually will have to watch a lot of VODs. Usually, for that, if I'm asked for that, I check out either VODs or recent playoff games. Also, in general, I keep a track on most big matches happening, and if I see anything interesting, I forward it to the rest of the staff. Besides VODs, of course, as an analyst, you try to keep a track on the data information which comes from competitive leagues in general, and even solo queue games.
Awesome. I'd love to dig more into your methodology when it comes to VOD review, because I think this is kind of like a dark art. No one really understands what it means. I think a lot of people assume that you'll just be watching games and they don't really know what else goes on. So can you just walk us through, if you were to do, let's say, a random VOD review of something that's going on in LCK, do you have Word documents open? Is it PowerPoints? Is it Google Sheets? Like, how are you tracking the information that you're seeing? And like, what sort of things are you looking out for? Are you skipping ahead to kind of certain timeframes, or do you watch games from start to finish? Like, how do you actually go ahead and do a VOD review?
Well, I think every analyst has his own method of watching VODs and how they document it. For me in particular, I'm comfortable with using an Excel sheet and just leaving a lot of timestamps for myself with notes on them. How I do it is usually I go through a match on 2x the speed, and I just forward it a lot using arrows on the keyboard, and I just jump every 10 seconds and I'm checking out the minimap to see positions of the players on the map. I also check out how the matchups go through like the scoreboard and how everything changes. And of course, if a matchup or a strategy catches my attention, I switch from minimap to watching what's happening on the lane itself. But in general, you want to get accustomed to using minimap a lot to get information fast. Have in general broad of sense what's going on in the game.
Right, okay, because this is a common saying people have when they're talking about reviewing games, is there's mistakes that are happening because someone's making a bad decision, and there are mistakes that happen because you clicked the wrong button, or you flashed in the wrong direction, or whatever it is. And I think these are kind of considered micro and macro mistakes, and I believe the common saying within the analyst community is micro mistakes aren't as important. So if someone failed to flash over a wall, there's not much you can say to a player, because obviously they wanted the flash over the wall, they failed it, they know the mistake. But macro mistakes, like you walk to the wrong lane, are something where you can actively help a player make better decisions in the future. Is that roughly right?
Yes, in general, micro coaching and macro coaching are very different in how you approach a VOD and how you approach working with a player. For me in particular, because I work with the staff, I rarely approach micro problems, because usually when you have a micro problem, you solve it with a player directly. So usually it's a type of VOD review which the coaches will do. While analysts tend to focus more on macro, because that is easier to convey to pretty much everyone else on the team.
Got it. So speaking about the infrastructure at G2, how does it work? Who is your boss? Who do you spend the most time with? Are there any other analysts in the team that you then need to interact with? How do you speak to the coaches, you know, and the players? Can you just give us a broad idea of what it is like in G2 as an analyst?
All right. G2 usually tends to have smaller coaching staffs, but we have more responsibility on hire staff members. So right now, besides managers, we have three staff members, which is Dylan, head coach, Rodrigo, head analyst, and me. Which I'm a junior analyst. You can call it scout analyst, I guess, or research analyst. Mostly, I spent a lot talking with Rodrigo. We watch scrims together, and we watch our opponents together. We prepared for playoffs, we prepared for MSI, we prepared for Worlds. And in general, I'm just trying to do my best work to him, for him, and have him review that and use it later with the rest of the team. And Rodrigo plays more of like head analyst, but he's also kind of assistant coach. So when it comes to players, he does all the approach on site, on bootcamp.
Awesome. That's really interesting to understand how it actually goes on behind the scenes, because I know when I was first looking into the industry, I wasn't sure if an analyst would be speaking directly to a player or a coach, or how they summarize the information. And what I'd be interested to know is, you said that when you're watching VODs, you have an Excel spreadsheet and it has some timestamps within that, and then you'll have a comment about what happens during that timestamp and maybe things you could learn. Is that the final output that goes to the team, or does it kind of go for another process where you have to summarize it all into a PowerPoint or into some bullet points that are kind of more digestible, or do you just send them the timestamps as they are?
I think that really depends on who you're preparing your work for. In general, for analysts, it's very important to know how to filter and present your information, especially when it comes to players. But it's a bit easier with staff, and especially with Rodrigo. In the past, I used to filter my information a lot for coaches, because, well, they want specific things, or you try to like tone it down to keep the most important information at the top. But for example, with Rodrigo is like, yeah, just send me everything, I will filter it out. Yeah, just whatever, just everything. I will see through it. So I'm just like trying to present it as best as I can, but he just like give me all the ideas, and I'm like, sure, you asked for it.
Got it. That must be very useful.
That's very enjoyable to work with, not gonna lie.
Yeah, because we've spoken to quite a variety of different people through this series, and there are some people who are maybe only working part-time, and maybe they don't speak that often to the coaches, and therefore the information they have to provide has to be very succinct, right? It has to be already compressed down to the key ideas. They can't just sort of send all of their thoughts to someone because there isn't enough time or enough people. So I think certainly it sounds like you guys have a really good relationship where you're able to provide information in the way that an analyst wants to see information, as opposed to having to then convert it into maybe something presentable to a player.
Kinda, but that's not full extent of my work. I still use the same method I used for the players to prepare for enemy teams. So in the past and right now, I work a lot with presentations, mostly PowerPoint, well, Google Slides. It's easier to work online. And in general, I just work a lot on my presentation and putting all the data into that presentation and giving it to Rodrigo after that. Generally, I came to using that method because, well, that's what everything uses, and that's how you always want to do it with the players. Like, you cannot link a spreadsheet to a player unless it's like just timestamps with some moments for him to watch. You generally always want to use presentation, and the quality and variety of information you can present varies significantly from analyst to analyst. I'm always happy to give feedback to our analysts, but in general, you can see what the differences in quality of design or quality of information filtering is very different, and I don't think a lot of people talk about that, although they may be thinking about it.
Cool. Can we dig into that in a bit more detail then? Because I'm sure there's plenty of people listening, or definitely in our Discord, who really want to become analysts. And one of the issues that I see quite often is how well they present the data. So they might be very good at getting data, whether it's VOD reviewing or going actually into the APIs itself, but they're not, they struggle when it actually comes to presenting it. They don't know what's important. They don't know how to format. Do you have any tips for people who are struggling to present data to players or coaches on the best principles on formatting data or formatting their work in a way that's understandable and easy to digest for players and coaches?
I think it's important to try to get into infographics and try to learn to minimize information and to use images instead of the text. It will help you a lot in your work. And as you can see, a lot of analysts, how they become more broad or like seen out there is by using simple infographics to gain traction on Twitter, so more coaches and analysts can see their work. And of course, that will not give anyone any depth on your work, but it will spread the word about your work pretty much enough for you to get noticed most of the time.
Yeah, there's that big difference between the your ability to do good work and your ability to let people know you're doing good work, and they're almost two different tasks, right?
Yeah, presented.
Yeah, like for instance, if you are working for a team, you probably don't need to create a web app, you know, something that allows people to kind of see your work, like a website or whatever. But if you're trying to find a team, that can be really useful because it gives people a place to kind of go and see all of the stuff that you've done, look at your portfolio, look at what statistics you've been able to produce, all those different things together. So they are kind of two different tasks. One you might not do if you're already in a team, one you should do if you're not in a team.
Yeah, I think a lot of analysts, they know how to get information and how to show it, but they are not sure what to present itself. For example, I know a lot of good analysts who created their sites or application, and you go in there and you see all the data or the objective timers or the timestamps, all the goal differences, and it looks good. It's very useful if you're staff, but it's not very useful to give it to the player, you know? So as a staff, you have this function, another function of filtering the information you get to the player himself, because the player, he will look at that data and he will be like, yeah, okay, it's good to know I have goal difference of plus 10 across all our streams. But like, besides confidence boost, that's not going to give him anything else.
Exactly. We call this the so what of data. So as an analyst, you should always be looking to achieve the so what. And that means if you say to someone, you have a goal difference of plus 200 at the 15 minute mark, it's like, so what? You know, what can I actually do differently? What am I going to change about the way I play or the way I approach the game from the data you're providing? Telling me a statistic is great, but like, so what? What can I actually do with it? So that's an incredibly important part of the role. And I'd love to understand more about what sort of things, what type of things are you delivering to a player or to Rodrigo that help change decisions? Is that items? Is it builds? Is it champions? Is it macro decisions? Is it potential players? Like what are the sort of the big topics of decision making that you're able to influence as a research analyst?
Well, in general, there's two ways you can work as an analyst in any team. It's working on your team and working or approaching opponents, like Sansa said, like half of victory is knowing yourself, another half is knowing your opponent. So in G2, Rodrigo is the one mostly working with the team. I try to like message him ideas from time to time. For example, like, look at solo queue, this champion is winning so much, or look at patch notes, or like, look at this crazy build in Korea. Do you think it's really good, or they are just getting bored? But for myself, I focus a lot on opponents. So I go across the data and votes, and I look at the opponents, and I'm like, okay, what of all this is useful? What can we use against them? In general, I try to present everything about the team, so you have a good broad sense of how they play, what they play, etc. But of course, I also try to get as much of my notes in well as well. For example, I think this player is always doing that, and that's very usable. Or this player always wants to play this matchup like that, or he always wards this bush at the start of a game. And in general, information like that can be really useful, and it's very approachable to the players. Because, for example, you can present them an idea of how we can try to play that game, and it can actually work out really well. Or you can look like a fool because the team did something all five of our games, and on the sixth game versus you, they didn't do it, but that's just life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the common sample size problem that we have. So, for instance, you may say, Caitlin Lux is really busted. You should definitely play it. And the team doesn't want to play it. And eventually you convince them to play it. And they lose that one game. And it's like, yeah, they lost one game, but maybe over 100 games, it would have been a strong duo. It's just there's not enough data a lot of the times. And given, especially in previous seasons for the LEC, we just didn't play enough games. There was 18 games a season. That's not enough to prove a point on a lot of cases. So it can be difficult because you put your neck out and you say, this is strong, we should do this. And then they lose that one game that they do it and you look like an idiot. But I mean, they could have played and won the game. You know, it's sometimes it just comes down to luck.
Yeah, anything is a percentage. If a player runs it down in 7 out of 10 games, there's still 30% chance he will not run it down. So,
yeah. Exactly.
You kind of have to present it like that. One thing I learned to do as an analyst is never to present something as a certainty, like everything is a possibility, and I try to emphasize that when talking to players, not to create like any misunderstandings or false narratives.
Yeah, don't ever use definitives. Never say they're definitely going to be playing this. They're 100% going to do this because you really don't know.
Not even using certainties. It's just you add possibly, maybe most of the time to almost everything you tell. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially, G2 are obviously an exception here, but if you are working for a lower tier team that, let's say, has a 25% chance of winning any of their games, some of the stuff you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to increase your win chance from 25% to 35%. And that's great, but they're still losing most of the games, right? So it's hard for someone to think that's valuable.
That sounds like most of my career.
Not this year.
I mean, yeah, everybody, some people had humble beginnings. Yeah, you know, I think in general for analysts, getting a whole 10% win rate chance is pretty remarkable. I would say you are LEC ready then. But in general, how you vet is there's three stages to how impactful a player is, not a player or a person in a team. Because everybody have different responsibilities, and for me, the first level of responsibility is the players. They have the most control of the game. In esports, we always commit to 5 players in generally, so all the responsibilities on them. After that comes coaches, which present a lot of information, interact with the players. And on the third level would be analysts. So the analysts' impact on the games would be in kind of tier 3. It still means you can do a lot in the game because you can impact the tiers above you, but still you got to be realistic about how much impact you actually have on the team.
Yeah, and it's immeasurable because most of the time an analyst will be joining during a roster move. And if you've got a completely different roster, it's very difficult to say how well the roster would have performed if you weren't there. So you could have had a team that wins everything. They win Worlds, but they might have won Worlds without you. So you never really know because a lot of the time the rosters are changing and there's a bit of luck. And it's so difficult to say that was me. I improved the team X amount.
Cool, let's
go back to the start of careers. I know this is one of the topics that people are very keen to hear about, and they're usually university students or they're recent graduates who have trying to learn and break into the esports industry. And a lot of the time these guys want to become analysts. Do you have any tips for people in that position who are just starting out in their career and they really want to break in? What do they do? How do they learn? What do they, what resources can they use to become better analysts and get those jobs?
Well, first of all, start working at works of other people. I also think it's okay to reach out and ask for examples or feedback on your work. Like most analysts I know in the scene are very open to it because we are sort of small community. We don't have like insane followers like the players or even the coaches. So usually a lot of people are very open to feedback and help you out on your way. Try to be like public on your work at the start because it may be easier like that to get either feedback or just help with your network in the future.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, this one comes up all the time is to share and get feedback. And I think a lot of people are hesitant because they feel like they, their work might get stolen. But you've got to have such an ego to think that an LEC staff member is going to steal your work when you're just trying to break into the industry. So the best thing to do is to publicize it, get criticism, get feedback and improve your work. And the chances of someone stealing your work are very, very slim.
Yeah, I also feel like you can also work on certain things which other analysts will appreciate and will be more willing to give feedback towards. For example, if you message me like some work or analyzing like G2 official games, I will get a chuckle and maybe I will give feedback, you know, because, well, why not? He used that time to look at my team. And not like I will leak anything, but in general, it's enjoyable to work, to watch the work of other people, even if they are new to the scene, because you kind of get the sense of, yeah, that's how I started, you know, and you get this like big brother vibes and you're like, yeah, I can, I will help you out. Sure, why not? I have time. In general, analysts, because we don't work as much as coaches and players, so you almost always will have time to work on more than one project or, for example, study alongside it. So try to do it in your spare time, I guess, because you will probably have time to do more than one thing.
Awesome. Great tip. Great tip. So as far as picking, so one of the things you said there was to publish your work. So let's go to into your role, which is the research kind of scouting analyst. I don't want to use just research analyst because you guys
just
have
call
got
it. Just call it scout analyst. It's fine.
Okay, scout / research analyst. One of the questions I get is, I want to do work and I want to publish it, but I don't even know where to start. Like, I don't know what to do, as in which topic I should look at. Do you have any tips for people who are just struggling to come up with ideas of things to do?
I mean, that's a very specific problem. I wouldn't say I have it, but that's because I started as a player, and because of that, I always had like a certain things in the game I appreciate the most. So if you play the game, you probably have a favorite role or favorite aspect of the game. For example, me, my favorite part was always macro. I play support position, so that's why I'm also less focused on the micro stuff. And it was always fun for me to look to either my position play or general sense of how the teams play the game. Try to think about what you enjoy about the game if you play it yourself, and if you don't, try to look at your favorite teams or their worlds look out for what you enjoy the most in the way they play. I think that's the best advice I can give.
Awesome. And I think just going on that, you're probably our highest ranked analyst that we've spoken to. I don't know where you are currently in your solo queue, but I definitely saw a master tier somewhere in your history. So how valuable do you find being in this high level of play compared to, let's say, a silver player who's trying to become an analyst?
First of all, I think being master tier allows me to have a broader perspective on subtopics, but I would not say it's something that's like makes a career for me, you know. It does not define my work as much as my general experience and how I view the game. A lot of times I would not even like be playing solo queue, and I would still learn a lot from having VODs, because solo queue and competitive are two very different experiences. You can get a sense of solo queue from playing, well, solo queue, but for competitive, you need to experience it yourself through either watching streams or even playing them themselves, and that gives you a broader sense of it. If you're somebody from silver and you're just starting, like you don't watch streams, you don't try to play competitive yourself, my best advice would be to just look at VOD analysis of other high-profile coaches and analysts and try to imitate that and try to copy their work. Besides that, you can also work with data that does not require VODs as much, but it will be harder for you to envelop it into the game later on.
Awesome. Is there any specific coaches that you know that publicize their work in a way that people could watch? I know Vegar V2 does publicizes some of his coaching ones, and I think you can pay as a Patreon to get some to unlock all of them. But is there anyone else that you can think of who does good VOD reviews, whether it's solo queue or professional?
I need to think of it, because I used to watch a lot more of VODs at the start of my career, but now I'm like a bit busy for it. I'm more jaded. And worst case, I can watch sometimes Dylan if they're playing on remote. I would say Vegar is a pretty good example, but Vegar, he's a positional coach in my eyes. So he's really good if you want to like learn to work with other players. But in general case, for a big macro reviewers, probably just look into any of LSC coaches who publicize their work, like Yamato, maybe even Cadrill. I know some LFL, like maybe Duke. Not sure if he posts any right now. But yeah, from top of my head, any coaches which are not actively on the team right now post word reviews from time to time.
Awesome. So yeah, even if it's not those three, I'm sure if you did a little bit of research, anyone could find some good coaches to review. So great tip there to go out there and just do some research, find out who's producing content on YouTube or Twitch or whatever, and just start watching that. It's a great place to start. You just get an idea of how they think. And I think that's half the battle, is to work out the perspectives of these coaches and like how they approach the game. Cool. We'll now move on to the Discord questions. And this is well timed, because we had one from Vegar. I don't know if I'm gonna get trolled for saying Vegar rather than Vigar, but either way, VV2 asked why is Rammus so OP?
Well, in general, I think Rammus was always pretty good in solo queue. I would not say it's good for competitive, because it's very hard to find a good spot for that competitive, because in competitive, usually you will get more balanced rosters, and Rammus is a champion which is very OP versus a certain archetype. So for me, the strength of Rammus is like goes up when it goes down, when it goes up. So in very low elo, he's very strong because he's very straightforward to play. And he also counters our champions, which are very straightforward to play. And in high elo, he will be more strong because he's still easy to play, and he counters a lot of champions, which are niche, and he, which a lot of OTPs in high elo use. Plus, he hard counters AD carries, which tend to be better at high elo. The reason why Rammus can seem kind of weak is because certain champions, especially in mid lane, feel very easy to play versus him. And because if you are a better player or you're not used to like hardcore Rammus one tricks, you generally can get a very good read at the champion because he just like runs at you very fast, and that's sort of has counterplay, especially if your champion can press a big Aoe stun cage.
Right, right. There's quite a few examples of this, actually, of champions that in low elo seem just like when you're climbing the ladder when you're first playing the game, just seem unbeatable, and you're like, how is this champion not nerfed? And then you work out the counterplay to it, and you're like, actually, this champion is really weak. I know Alawi is a good example of one that in low elo can just smash face because people try and just pile in on her, not realizing that when she uses her ultimate, she's going to 1v5, but when that's on cooldown, she's pretty useless as a champion, or just dodge the E, or the, you know, sort of certain concepts that champions, if you don't understand that, can feel unbeatable, but then once you work out, actually are very not unbeatable at all, and quite easy. Awesome. So we're going to take another question from the Discord, a bit of an older one, which is around about the meta in professional play. And I saw a really good tweet recently. I wish I could remember who it was. I think it was Molecule, who was saying around about the sort of the way that professional play works is we kind of find a meta that is good, but might not be the absolute optimal because no one wants to take the risk of trying to find out a new meta. Is that something you agree with? Do you think the meta could be more optimized? Or do you think that in general, professional is played in kind of the highest level it can be?
I think in League, it's hard to say the meta is developed. I think there's always potential for any meta to be developed and to be perfected. Some players will always be open to try new stuff, but I don't think they are very good at searching for it themselves because in general, a lot of players attend solo queue with the mindset of, well, I will try it because it sounds fun. And if it works, well, that's an added bonus. I think that's a lot how meta changes. Like, for example, how Heimerdinger or MF support came into the metas, or how like you can come up with weird counter picks in our lanes. But in general, it will come from players who try it in solo queue for fun. I think the problem with League is every meta develops over time, but because League is a highly patched game, it's almost impossible to reach the perfect meta. And as long as it's patched, I don't think there will be any point in time in which the best meta for the patch will be found because they're just coming out so fast.
Got it, right. So even if you are able to head in the right direction of the optimal, there isn't enough search time between patches to actually work out what it is. So even if you did something outrageous and started looking all over the game to try and find different ways of optimizing, by the time you found it, there's a patch and it's no longer the optimal anyway.
Yeah, it's also the fact that, for example, you can try to develop, for example, let's say some champion is OP. Let's say Illaoi is OP. Like it's S tier, everybody bans it or everybody first picks it. You will have then a choice as a team. Do you either like ask your player to develop a certain counter pick it so you can play against it, like develop a strategy around it so you don't have to ban it, or you just wait for Riot to nerf it? Because Riot is like very, it can take 6 months for an OP champion to be nerfed. And then it makes sense that you develop a counter pick, but maybe he will be nerfed next patch. And when you just like wasted time to learn this very niche counter and the champion is just already nerfed and like nobody knows when you will use that counter again. So that's also a problem when it comes to developing counter meta.
Yeah, and the same for not just countering, but playing the champion itself. Like even if a champion's broken, if you're first timing it in pro, you're probably going to struggle even though it's broken. Like that, you have to put in a certain amount of hours. Even if you played the champion before, you need to put a certain amount of hours in the current state of that champion just to get a feel for where the damage bars are and what sort of can you 1v5 that, just to get a feel of it, right? Yeah, and then it gets nerfed, so it was a waste of time. And that's why a lot of champions that are consistently played in pro play are consistently played, because they are in the meta for most of the year, therefore it makes a lot of sense to practice them because you have a low risk that they kind of fall off the meta.
A lot of time, as an analyst, you will look over the data, especially specific regions, and see some champions being highly played, even if they are not very strong, just because that's something players already develop and accustomed to. So that's kind of knowledge which comes over time, but LEC, LPL, LCK, all those solo queue ladders have champions which are not the best at the moment, but just because the region developed a culture for playing them in the solo queue or competitive, they will always be picked there. Unless they are absolutely nerfed to the ground, which will probably not happen.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool. So we'll go on to our final question that we ask all of our analysts, which is, what is your favorite statistic?
My favorite statistic. All right, my favorite statistic. I would say my favorite statistics is probably first tower taken by lane for a team, because I think that's quite an interesting data which allows you to see how a team usually wants to play. Most teams are not very like monotone. They don't just go, oh yeah, we will play through bot lane, all split, we never come top, we never herald, you know. So usually just seeing which first tower the team gets lets you a bit more information than ours. And I don't want to pick some boring statistics like goal difference or jungle proximity, because I think everybody already picked it.
It's true. As the 10th interview, we're running low on options. I think jungle proximity has come up 3 or 4 times already. So that is a new and niche one. We haven't heard that before. So
jungle proximity is vanilla flavor of statistics.
It's only because most of us have only just got access to that level of data that we can actually create it. It's just exciting. Awesome. So what percentage, which lane tower falls first as a percentage? 33% would be kind of the baseline. And then does the team have are they more likely to take Herald bot and try and funnel their ADC, for instance?
Usually Herald, you watch it differently, but it's interesting to see which towers which teams tend to take first. After that, you can also go in depth. You can work at tier 2 towers, but that's already another layer. And like, if you want to look really, really deeply into a team, or they play a lot of Fiora Jax, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's hard to break it out, especially because it might be that they had 3 Fiora Jax games where they got top tier 2 first, but every other game they don't get top tier 2 first, right? So it's then difficult to say, because you might be saying to your team they take top tier 2 first a lot, but actually they don't. It's only when they're picking Fiora Jax that they end up doing that.
It's also the fact that you always have to contextualize your data. So even once you get like the data sample, you usually will have to briefly watch over the games themselves, like what was picked, why it happened, because otherwise you are at risk of interrupting that in a bad way. There's also like unique case for data like that, because once you reach the highest tier of play, which is not really a problem if you're working at the European Regional League, because you can scrim other leagues. But if you're at like LEC or LCK or LPL or Brazil and America, you will kind of have to scream other teams in your league. And that creates a third level of data. So for example, in the European League, you will have 2 levels of data. You will have solo queue and you will have competitive. But in big leagues, you will also have the third set of data to work with, which is like scrims against our teams you will play in the future, which is not quite competitive, but it's still another set of data you can work with.
Yeah, and it's a weird type of data, because it is, like you say, not actually
it's very volatile. It's volatile, right. Very.
So for instance, you can't, not a lot of people know this if you're not in the scene, but you can't do average game time within scrims because teams forfeit at 15 minutes and 20 minutes quite often because they'll say we were testing something new in the early game. We didn't do it well. There's no point playing it out. We're 10K behind. So there's no point relying on game length because a lot of the games are just cut short from forfeits.
I mean, it depends. You can also try to cut out those games, but in general, the data in scrims will be very volatile and you have to treat it as such.
Yeah, exactly. So scrim results are useful, but certainly do not rely on them to to assume what's going to happen. Cool. Click, this has been an awesome interview. It's been really great to have you on and have your perspective, which I think is really unique compared to a lot of the analysts we've spoken to. So thanks again for joining us. Is there any sort of social medias or anything like that you want to plug whilst we've got you, where people can find you and speak to you?
Yeah, sure. Feel free to message me on Twitter at click4x. You can always ask me some questions. I will try to answer my best. If I left you on read, probably because I was busy, it happens. But in general, the people in the analytic community, I think, are very open and friendly. So yeah.
Definitely. Everyone I've spoken to has been, including yourself. So thanks again for joining us, Clay. It's been a great interview and I'll speak to you soon.